Mush Mix Massacre 4, August 2nd, 2021.
Smoke will make you choke. Deep in the heart of Jersey and the city rats run in big packs. Deep in the heart of Jersey, oh, the parkway man takes the money from your hand. Deep in the heart of Jersey and old Route 17, the traffic there is mean. Deep in the heart of Jersey. City skies ain't fit for flies. Deep in the heart of Jersey, Route 80 West goes through the best. Patterson, New Jersey, oh, the dumps in June ain't like perfume. Deep in the heart of Jersey, but it's my state, I think it's great. Deep in the heart of Jersey, deep in the heart of Jersey, deep in the heart of Jersey, yippee-yay!
Hey folks, Vaughn here, another week. I know it's been a couple weeks since I've recorded. I've been trying to keep on the whole weekly thing, but sometimes it's a little tough when you have a lot of things going on, especially when you have a colonoscopy, which I did today, which turned out very well for me, which is good, you know? No polyps, none of that shit. I know it's fun to talk about someone's colon, but it was a relief. I've been nervous about it the last couple weeks. Plus that, with working 12-hour days, I just don't particularly want to record, you know? But I did watch some movies. Tonight we're going to do two... This is part two of the selected works of Robert Downey Sr., a prince. And we're going to do Putney Swope, Pound, and Greaser's Palace. Three films that are very interesting. From what I've watched, I've only watched two documentaries. I watched Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, which I saw in the theater. First time back in the theater. It was really nice to kind of pick that as the first time going back. And I'm on vacation the next 2 weeks, and my friends, we've kind of planned out some movies to go see before they split. Want to go see the Black Widow film, want to go see the Green Knight, maybe Jungle Cruise at some point in the next 2 weeks. You know, just kind of getting it back in the theater. It's just good times had by all. So Roadrunner is a film, it's a film about Anthony Bourdain, you know, like just what the title suggests. This was directed by Morgan Neville, who has made stuff like I Want to Be Your Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary a couple years ago. They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, the making of The Other Side of the Wind, the Orson Welles lost film that got reissued a couple years ago. 30 Feet from Stardom, Best of Enemies. Did a couple other really great documentaries, right? So this documentary talks about Anthony Bourdain through the lens of his friends and collaborators, right? A couple things that bother me about the film. Originally, when I put it on Letterboxd, I originally gave it 4 stars. And then over the weekend, some controversies kind of popped up. And other things that I kind of just thought about. So one controversy that popped up was that in the documentary, they used an AI voice of his to put some lines out there that are in the... Most of the lines in the film are from things from, you know, his many TV shows. There is one segment where Neville got access to his diaries and some other writings and loved it and wanted to use it, but Bourdain never actually said these things out loud, or at least on camera, through the many years of voice work he had done. And they kind of AI'd it, with much not... Even though Neville had said that he got the okay from Bourdain's last wife, they really didn't. And it's just kind of false, and it really falls false. Another thing that they do in it, if you don't know who Anthony Bourdain is, he was a writer, a chef, not like a kind of like, you know, like a Emeril Lagasse type chef, but a guy who wrote about food, and did TV about food, and kind of changed a lot of people, including my own mind about food and the experience of living life and whatnot. Anyway, he died of suicide 3 years ago, 2018. And so it's very fresh with everybody's head. So a handful of things that were going on in his life at the time was that he had recently got divorced, and he had recently kind of started staying, when he would actually be home, stay in his house, become more agoraphobic and kind of just creepy, just get weirded out because he didn't feel like he had anything. He started dating Aja Argento, Dario Argento's daughter. And the documentary puts it out that maybe his obsession with her and her cheating might have caused his suicide. It kind of puts it there. They don't interview Argento, which is just like, because his director has, you know, whoever they can pick, and they probably had some kind of NDAs with people, and they probably didn't want to, she probably didn't want to be involved in it, because the film itself is a lot of people that work with him, his second wife, they didn't get his first wife, David Chang and David Cho, which I think were great pieces, those two, as you know, and David and Josh Homme of Queens of the Snowland, Queens of the Stone Age, anyway, but they don't get her. And there was other things that was going on at the time with him. One being that Argento was one of the figureheads of the Me Too movement a handful of years ago, right? It came out after Bourdain's death that she had sexually assaulted a young man, a 17-year-old that she knew, that he was in one of her films as a child, right? And they had this kind of a relationship as like kind of like his second mother, right? She got him into a hotel room to kind of discuss working on a project, got him drunk, gave him oral sex, and had sex with him, much for his, not to his chagrin, right? She denied it, right? But then it came out later through a model that she was friends with that, kind of leaked all these text messages they had that were telling the truth, right? Right before Bourdain died, Bourdain, took a meeting with the kid and paid him off. They don't bring this up in the movie at all, right? All this was found out after Bourdain died, but the kid ended up coming out because he felt that she was getting too much spotlight for the things that other people have done, when she's just as bad as the people that have done these things to her, right? It's very true. Anyway, so it could have, who knows? Bourdain didn't leave a suicide note, so he, it was just a spur of the moment thing. Suicide's that kind of way, It's that whole kind of like, I don't know. I really don't want to talk about suicide right now. I've had many people in my life kind of commit it. So not go through with it, but, attempt it. It's not a fun thing. Anyway, but they leave those things out. The only thing they talk about with Argento is that he became obsessed with her, and that she started working on the No Reservations, or forget which version of the show he was doing, the CNN show. She started directing some episodes, and she was butting heads with some people who were longtime people, and Bourdain would just fire them because he didn't like the way they were acting around her. And a lot of people thought that was really bad. And another thing with Bourdain was that he was getting sick of doing the show. He wanted to take the time off. He wanted the break. But his producers and everybody else were very, very adamant against that, because, he was making tons of money and doing tons of great work. But he was kind of burnt out. But the one thing they bring up with Argento is that she was, in the papers, in the tabloid, she was kind of seen with another man, and maybe that was the cause of it. But there's a whole kind of factors that they don't bring in, which is kind of silly. Another documentary I saw was for Mad Men Only. This came out last year. It's now getting a release here on digital. It's a documentary about the comedian guru Del Close. Now, you don't know who Del Close is? You probably don't. He popped up in a bunch of movies back in the 70s and 80s, but he's most well known for training every improv comic in the last 30 years, from Belushi to like Farley, Amy Poehler, and Stephen Colbert, and all that stuff. He trained all these people, right? And he is the godfather of the of ongoing interpretation. What the fuck's it called? Shit. I don't know. But he was a madman. He was a true crazy person who had been put in institutionalized twice within his time period. And it tells you the life and story of him, and the fact that he had a deal with DC to write a comic book about his life, which I really want to try to find, called Wasteland. And it's a combination of interviews, archival footage of him during performances or classes, and scripted segments with actors playing the characters around while they're setting up and trying to write this comic book. I've been kind of looking forward to it since last year. I think it showed at Sundance last year, and it was kind of, a lot of people wrote about, you know, positive things about it. And I was like, okay. And it's fun. You know, for a 90-minute documentary, it tells you exactly what you need to know about the guy if you never heard of him. Shows you his influence on all these people, which is really cool. Also, it shows that his influence on these people kind of work in a bad way, too, because the guy who works with... who did all the Anchorman films and whatnot, all those kind of films, and how they kind of just improv all the time, and they kind of cut it together to work, and how those movies are awful, and how, like, improv movies are kind of awful nowadays. It's kind of his fault, because he trained all those people. Anyway, I liked it, though. It's on every silly-ass fucking on-demand thing. You know, you can buy it anywhere. Rent it anywhere. Anyway. Yeah, let's tackle the next three films. So, this episode is going to be long form, 90-minute films. I know that there was one 85-minute film in the last one, but these are the kind of film people, these are the movies that he's known for as a cult director. Anyway, so let's go and tackle them, why don't we?
One vote for Elias, one vote for Bissinger, 9 votes for Swope.
Swope! You don't have to accept. It's a terrible job. Don't take it, Swope!
The man's been elected and you voted for him.
We all voted for him because we thought no one else would vote for him. Putney Swope is the new chairman of this board. And I will defend that mistake with my life.
Mr. Swope, I do exactly the same job as the other executives, but I don't make as much money as they do. I don't think that's right.
If I give you a raise, everybody's gonna want a raise. And if I give them a raise, they'll still be making more money than you. And we'll be right back where we started.
You can't eat an air conditioner.
Who did that?
You did. It was your idea.
Not bad. Not bad.
Putney Swope, 1969, directed and written by Robert Downey Sr. Starring, Arnold Johnson, Seth Gottlieb, Alan Garfield, Richie Russell, Roman Gordon, Burt Lawrence, Joe Madden, not that Joe Madden, Antonio Fargas, Lauren Green, Alan Arbus, who pops up in another film this week, Pepe Herman, Ruth Hemme, Shelley Plimpton, Martha Plimpton's mom, Elizabeth Selznick, Peter Maloney, Marilyn Clark, a whole bunch of fucking people. I'm not going to go through this whole damn thing. Mel Brooks pops up in it in a small fucking role. Anyway, Putney is the only black executive in a ad firm. The head of the ad firm dies during an argument at a meeting. The son of the owner of the firm says that they need to do a vote right now. So they do. But one stipulation, they can't vote for each other. So everybody thinks and votes for Putney because thinking that no one would vote for him. Everybody does. Putney then pretty much, you know, as a quiet person up to this point, he is a very staunch, matter-of-fact kind of guy who doesn't pull punches. And has some great one-liners. There's one, I never chase foul balls, which is a thing I've been using on dating sites for years. Up until, well, I'm doing using it now again, too. But before I wasn't married, I was using it then, too. But nobody reads that shit, right? Anyway, so he decides to change the place to Truth and Soul, Inc. Fires all the executives, including the rest of the white people who work there. Only bringing in black people. And he puts out a staunch thing. I don't want to sell the alcohol, tobacco, or toys for kids, guns and stuff like that. And they all kind of, at one, are kind of shocked by this. But then the rest of the people who are in there trying to sell their wares are, oh, and he wants the top dollar. He wants it in cash. So $1 million in cash, and I'll do your fucking ads. Which we get intercut into things. So the story itself is stark black and white. And then you have these very colorful ads, very, you know, shot, you know, and they're all about, like, just weird stuff. Like, it's not anything you'd ever see actually made. And Downey was known before he started making film, or actually while he started making film, his short films, was that he worked for an experimental film house that got jobs from companies, and they would make these weird fucking ads, and some of them actually ran. For like, you know, women's beauty cream and this, that, and the other thing. And it was ultimately a test for the companies to come and like, okay, now we know how we can play this. We can't really use these ads you're making, but we actually know now how to work and actually make ads for our products. So he was working within the advertising, and it was kind of a shot in the arm for the advertising establishment at the time. He was trying to force people who were going into it to look at this film and go, hey, this is not the place you want to be. You're not going to be creative. You're going to make this junk, right? Become a filmmaker. Work somewhere else. Work in the arts, right? Because you're just going to be saddled. But he would meet people at screenings, especially screenings in the last, like, 20 years. There's some great interview, archival interviews with him on the Putney Swope Blu-ray from Vinegar Syndrome, where he talks about kids would come up to him and say, hey, this movie got me into advertising. He's like, oh, fuck, what? Like, it would just kind of work backwards. And another thing is, even though people think this is the best film out of his collection of films, like all the movies he ever made, he didn't like it. He liked it, but he didn't think it was one of his best. It's a film he did, I forget, like maybe a handful of years later that he thought was his best. Not the ones we're talking about tonight, but he definitely didn't think this was his best film. I like it. I like the fact that one thing that you'll notice if you watch the film is that Arnold Johnson's, that's not Arnold Johnson's voice. It's actually Robert Downey Sr. voicing him over, because Downey had a lot of problems with him because he couldn't remember lines or he'd flub lines, and they were working on a very tight budget and a very tight schedule. They would go into these office buildings and do these scenes at night. The people who worked in the offices would leave, and they would come in and just do their thing all night. And they only had a handful of days, I think maybe a couple of weeks to do it. Really, really fast shooting schedule. And he would fuck up these lines all the time. And the other guys who were in there, who were just kind of playing small parts and whatnot, were just coming to go, hey, fire him. I can do this better. No. And one day, his cinematographer came up and said, hey, he's got that beard. No one can really see his lips. You can do whatever the fuck you want. And so he decided to voice the dub over him. Arnold Johnson kind of took that offense at first, but ultimately, before his death, he was kind of saying to people that was probably the best decision to do because I wasn't that great of an actor at the time, which is great. I like it because I like the whole aesthetic of Putney Swope. He's this guy who takes no shit. He's got some really fun attitude about his whole thing. He gets in love with a woman and, you know, takes her ideas and uses them. Everybody kind of knows this. He's ultimately acting like the revolutionary, but he's really not. You know, he's just another guy who's letting all these people kind of like take his ideas and run with them. It's a fun film. There's a lot more to laugh at just in the kind of weird ads that he pops in between everything that kind of break up the story. Like I said, a lot of people have great one-liners. You have like a little really great talented actors playing, and there's some really fun scenes, like a scene where assassination sequence where one of the white guy who's been doing the labor work, who's been keep telling to use the labor elevator, the freight elevator, comes in and shoots out the place. Doesn't kill anybody, but you know, because it's a horrible shot. And the guy who's supposed to be protecting him is like his armed man has lost his gun. And you see this a couple times throughout the film. So the guy keeps misplacing his gun or dropping it. And he's not that particularly tough of a dude. It's just he's tough with the gun, but he doesn't know how to use it. And when he needs to use it, it's not there. It's pretty silly. The ending with the explosion of the big bank of money that they have in the basement of the place is crazy because it's just, you definitely know that the actors weren't sure what was going to happen. And when it explodes like that, everybody jumps out and fucking freaks out. It's a great way to end that film. Like I said, there is an out-of-print DVD from Criterion called Up All Night with Robert Downey Sr. It's got all these films on it that I talked about the last 2 or 3 weeks. And there's also a really great Blu-ray from Vinegar Syndrome. I think they also put it on DVD, but there's a really great... it's a combination of DVD Blu-ray. Some really great archival interviews with him. A Q&A with him. Sorry. It's just a really fun film. I don't know. Like I said, it's out there. I think you can actually watch it on Tubi now, too, right now, if you want to watch it. I know, I'm a big schlub for Tubi, but hell, man, they got stuff on there. It's cool. Put it up, you know, tell them.
Texas. One night there's a tornado warning, so we all go down in the basement and we lay down in the southwest corner. The tornado hits, the lights go out, the wind is blowing, but we're all hanging on to each other like one piece of fear. The next morning we go upstairs, there's no more furniture, the roof's gone, and so's my hair. That tornado scared me so much it made my hair disappear.
Have any hair on your balls?
I'm afraid to look.
Don't be afraid to look at yourself, you're perfect.
1970, Pound, written and directed by Robert Downey Sr. Starring Charles Dirklap, Don Sheafy, Antonio Fargas, Chuck Green, Robert Downey Jr. in his first actual film role. I think his wife, Eloise Downey, would pop up in this movie too. Eloise Downey, Seth Gottlieb, a bunch of his kind of collaborators and whatnot. So anyway, all these people play dogs that are sitting in a kennel waiting to either be adopted or euthanized, right? And I know that's the crazy idea, right? All these weird dogs, boxers, a Siamese cat, an air doll, a mutt bitch played by Eloise Downey, an old Pekingese, an Irish Setter, an Italian Terrier, a Greyhound, a mutt, played by a dachshund, all these kind of dogs, all played by people. And the great thing is that it starts off with a kid bringing in a very old dog to a mound of dirt to kind of bark for his friend. Right, you later find out one of the dogs in there is in the pound is his friend. Anyway, we then get introduced to the dog catchers who drop off a dog to the pound, and the woman who's running, who's kind of like keeping an eye on the dogs, brings the dog in. And as the dog gets transferred into the pound, it goes into a human, which is a really kind of fun transition. And it's these dogs kind of arguing and fighting, kind of like typical human beings, about sex and death. There is kind of a pseudo-rape scene, but it's like, because they're dogs, is there really a rape scene? Like, let me think about it. Like, think about that. Because they're playing dogs, is there really a rape scene? Anyway. Arguing, complaining about silly, stupid bullshit. Kind of like all humans do. Right? And it's not really... That's pretty much all I have to explain about it. Like, it's... The performances of all the people in the pound, in this kind of caged-off area, are fun. They're kind of playing their characters and what kind of dogs they are, very interestingly. And they all have like backstories, and they all have different things that have made them the people or the animals that they are now. There are some like weird kind of freak out scenes in it, where they all escape, where they all get let go, and it's like love the thing. And it's like, there's a scene where they're having a court session. Like, it's like, okay. And it's ultimately these dogs just kind of wasting time arguing with each other and talking to each other and trying to escape and trying to do this and trying to come to terms with what's wrong with them, what's going to happen to them if they don't get adopted. I know this is short, but like, I really like this film. I thought it was really fun. The problem with this film is that there is not a copy of it released. There are two versions of it on YouTube. One that's really shitty with like an old barcode, like a time code on it. And then there's one that's a really good version, which has got Israeli subtitles on it. It's the only way you can see the film. I don't think it's ever been released on DVD here. It should be. It's probably like, it's a trying. I think it's out of the three films, I think it's the best, even though I love the third film in the series. But again, it's really well written. It's really well acted. He has this great cast of people who are just playing these characters to the hilt. And you can just believe that they're playing dogs and cats and whatnot. I know a lot of people didn't like this film when it came out, but I really wish that it needs to be re-examined. You know, especially there's so many cult and like oddball and kind of genre film writers nowadays. I'd love them to sit down and talk about this film. I know I'm the only one doing it. I know, and then somebody a couple years from now, somebody who's much more in clout, we'll talk about this film and praise it, and it'll get a Blu-ray release or some bullshit. But it's fun. It's very fun.
You're on. If you feel, you heal.
I was swimming with millions of babies in a rainbow, and they was naked. And then all of a sudden, I turned into a perfect smile.
I'm sorry I brought you back, but I need your help.
Who are you?
I'm sorry I brought you back, but I need your help. I'm on my way to Jerusalem to be an actor singer. It is written that the agent Morris awaits me.
Let's go. Well, come on.
Oh.
Greaser's Palace, 1972. Written and directed by Robert Downey Sr. Starring Alan Arbush. Well, no. So one thing I found out in this, in one of the many interviews I watched and listened to with Downey, was that Arbush's wife, the painter, now I gotta find out what her name is, Diane Arbush, killed herself while they were making this film. Crazy. Another thing about Alan Arbush is that he was in MASH. I know, right? We've talked about two MASH actors this year so far. Alan Alda with To Kill a Clown and this guy. Sadly, he died at 95 in 2013. 95, I mean, come on. Jesus. But his best known role is MASH. Anyway. So, this film, this is why I like this film the most, is that... What the hell is it? Alan Arbush plays Jesse, a man who is parachuted in to a western town in the American frontier. And I said parachuted. He lands in a parachute. He is dressed in a zoot suit and hat, right? And he has no memory of who he is. Right? He is headed to this town. He's headed to Israel to meet with a agent from William Morris, right? But he comes across this town run by a man named Seaweed Head Greaser, played by Albert Henderson, a tyrant who is got the only place in town to drink and enjoy yourself, but also collects all the taxes. Huh. Weird. Right? He keeps his mother and his favorite mariachi band in cages on the roof of the bar/cabaret he runs. He also is extremely constipated. Like I said, Jesse has amnesia. Remembers nothing but the fact that he needs to get to the talent agent Morris in Israel. Right, so you have him going around. You have also Eloise Downey, who is playing a woman who is, you know, taking, you know, cupboard, you know, Oregon Trail style across the plains with her son and her husband. And her husband and son are killed by Indians. One thing about the film is that it doesn't give the Indians a great name. I mean, all films in the 70s give Indians a great name, but whatever. Anyway, Jesse resurrects the greaser's son, who played by Michael Sullivan, who is killed by Seaweed Head Greaser for being a homosexual, right? And he is brought back multiple times. Because he only has one kind of, you know, savior. Anyway. Jesse kind of shows off his powers. He heals the sick. Kind of. Tap dances on the water. You know, and he becomes the biggest attraction that Seaweed Head Greaser kind of takes in. Pissing off Seaweed Head Greaser's daughter, who has been the main attraction in his revival house for years. Right? And Greaser is losing money because, well, his daughter isn't that much of an attraction anymore. Everybody's seen her so many goddamn times, no one cares. So this is a goofy allegory on the resurrection and death of Jesus Christ. Jesse is playing Jesus. There is a scene where he is doing a zoot zoot kind of volley number where he does his whole thing and then he takes his gloves off and screams as his hands, who have holes in them, both sides, bleed. There's another scene with, what's his name? Hervé Villechaize, with his sister, who is a man dressed in drag, grabs old Jesse by the balls and squeezes, and he screams fucking bloody murder. If I can find that scene, I will put it in, because it's fucking violently weird. Anyway, you know, things happen. Jesse tries to not be the savior that he has to be, which he does. He ends up being. There's a great picture that I have as a screensaver, as a wallpaper on this computer, of Jesse on the cross, you know, in his suit. It's a very violent scene where when he dies, he gets his hands actually. You know, they show Eloise Downey nailing his hands and feet to the cross. And the reason why is so with his death it resurrects her child and son. It's kind of a weird allegory. You also have a man running around in a sheet who is the son of God, not son of Joseph, I think he is. And you have also God running around with an invisible gun, just shooting and killing people, anyone he wants. Very haphazardly. So this film, from what I've heard, is that a Broadway producer friend of Downey's called Seaman Rubin gave Downey $1 million to make the film. They went to New Mexico and made the film for $1 million. It looks like they made it for $1 million. And it looks like his producer had no, you know, was trying to get into film and was like, hey, Downey wants to make a movie. I know him. I got money. Let him do it. The film's kind of going on to be one, it's cited as one of the worst films ever made. A B-movie hell type of film. Two, it's a, it's a fun midnight film, which I think probably did get put in the midnight movies. And also, it's kind of an acid western with the whole concept of what's going on. You have all these dirty fucks, and you have this clean, clean-clothed Jesse roaming around in his zoot suit, doing his zoot suit stuff, which is just silly when you see him. He's out in the middle of the field just dancing and bopping and beeping and going all over the place, and you're like, okay. Alan Arbus really had a good time with this film, it seems like. He really enjoyed it, even though his wife had killed herself while they were making the film. I don't know. I really enjoy this film. I do. I think it's a real fun romp. And there is, it's on Tubi, but there was a Blu-ray release by Scorpion releasing. I think either not through Kino. I think through Ronin Flicks. The film got a couple. It got a lot of praise for it. Here's one thing from the Time magazine's Joe Cox: Downey's funniest and most accomplished and most audacious film. It's the most adventurous American movie so far this year. But it also didn't receive great things. So here's one from Thomas Mahan of the Saturday Review. Robert Downey seems to have absolutely everything to take to be successful, movie director, except talent. And though this was a film even worse than his early pictures, an absurdist incomprehensible Western that mixes scatological William Moore's agents and Second Coming of Christ. It's like, I don't know. I find it very fun. I find it very unique and definitely its own kind of madness. I mean, it's definitely, for a guy who's an atheist, I find it a very funny film. I'm about God. I think that's all I have to say. I know this is very rushed. I'm going to get you another episode out tomorrow at some point with a guest host. So don't be worried. You didn't like this one? Anyway, voicemail, because no one calls me. 732-639-1435. That's 732-639-1435. Or email me, motionpicturemassacre. I hope these last two episodes make you go out and find these films. Like I said, Greaser and Putney are both on Tubi. Pound is on YouTube in different versions. The other films are accessible. I think they're on YouTube as well. Just go out and find his movies. It's well worth it. The man did a lot of great work for the long portion of life he lived here. So, thanks. Actually, I might, before I shit myself, especially like a lot yesterday, my God, fasting like a motherfucker, I shit myself almost 3 times. Before I shit myself, goodbye.
Hey, Godzilla! It's over! You must forgive! Damn lizard!